Hello, this is Leslie Garfa-Tenzer, and this is Legal Tenzer, casual conversations on noteworthy legal topics. The 13th Amendment is best known for abolishing slavery and indentured servitude. However, it also gives Congress the authority to pass laws that further systems connected to slavery. On this episode, Professor Etienne Toussaint discusses his thoughtful argument on how to invoke the 13th Amendment to resolve issues of food insecurity among historically marginalized communities. He notes that the antebellum system of chattel slavery invokes the legislative potential of the 13th Amendment's Enforcement Clause. During the discussion, Professor Toussaint identifies key dignitary harms, like the right to liberty, the right to equality, and the right to integrity. And we take an interesting digression into the history of Black farmers and their plight today. I'm sure you'll enjoy this episode. So thank you so much for joining me. This is a really interesting topic that I don't think people know enough about. Your recent article, Abolition of Food Oppression, came out in Georgetown, and I'd love to focus a little bit on your thesis. I guess the question that you pose is, can we use the 13th Amendment to address food insecurity in our country? I do want to take a step back. The 13th Amendment obviously is about abolition, but can you just give us a little more explanation of what the 13th Amendment is and how you would like to use it to address food insecurity today?
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for inviting me, and I'm happy to be in conversation with you and to share a little bit about this paper. Most listeners will know the 13th Amendment in its relationship to the abolition of slavery, right? So after the Civil War, slavery was abolished informally by Abraham Lincoln with the Emancipation Proclamation, but formally, the institution of slavery was abolished via the 13th Amendment. And specifically, it abolishes not only slavery, but also indentured servitude. What some people do not know is that there is a second clause in the 13th Amendment that gives Congress legislative authority to pass laws and policies that would further enact the abolishing process, which is to say there was some understanding that it wasn't simply enough to say slavery has been abolished, but that Congress also needed to be empowered to pass laws, policies, to ensure that the formerly enslaved class could really experience the full privileges and full rights and opportunities of citizenship. And so there's a sense in which the 13th Amendment is not only about abolishing slavery, but it's also about positioning the enslaved class to fully experience citizenship.
So I guess I'm unaware, and I probably should be, of any laws post the 13th Amendment that Congress passed. Can you give us some examples of some of the laws they used and policies they were trying to achieve?
That's a great question. Well, there were a number of efforts put into place during the Reconstruction era to address the transition from slavery to emancipation. And that was put forward by what we might call the Reconstruction Congress. At the time, radical Republicans were the ones that were putting forward some of these laws. The first was the 1866 Civil Rights Act, which I'll come back to, but effectively was trying to ensure that the formerly enslaved class or other marginalized populations had the same contract and property rights as enjoyed by white citizens at that time. There was an Anti-Peonage Act passed in 1867, which again was thinking about modes of labor that perpetuated the same kinds of oppression and subordination that the slavery system furthered. There was a 8-Hour Act in 1868 that was passed, again, thinking about how to create a workplace that dignified the laborer and allowed them to experience citizenship in an equal way. And immediately, and not shortly after the 13th Amendment was passed, we also saw a number of other amendments, the 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment, that most people talk about the three as a package because they collectively were trying to ensure that the formerly enslaved class could experience the different aspects of citizenship that are critical, not just being able to work, but also being able to engage in the democratic process by voting. And the 14th Amendment really addressed trying to eliminate laws that were on the books that prevented the equal experience of citizenship. And so during the antebellum era, there were slave codes that existed that regulated what enslaved people could and could not do, where they could go, what they could own, how they could congregate, et cetera, whether they could assemble to practice their faith, et cetera. Many of those laws were transformed into Black codes after the abolition of slavery. And these are state laws that in many ways tried to reinscribe the social system that existed during the era of slavery.
So what's interesting to me is the idea of taking this amendment that was established quite a while ago and bringing it into the present day. And food insecurity is a real thing. We hear about it quite often. We see it. How is it that this amendment is applicable to today? And might I add, it's unfortunate that we need it, but how is it applicable to food insecurity and in particular food insecurity today?
That's a fantastic question. Well, I will say I'm not the first person to think about the 13th Amendment in a progressive way. There have been many scholars that have done so in a number of different domains. Andrea Freeman is a scholar who has thought about this in the context of food and food justice, and she's written a little bit about this. And I think my work in many ways is trying to build upon some of the fantastic scholarship that she's put out on this topic. And many scholars would point to, I think, one case that arguably is an exception to the rule with respect to how courts think about the 13th Amendment, but nevertheless is a great example of the potential and scope and of how it can address broader issues in society. And that is a 1968 case called Jones v. Alfred H. Mayer Company. That is a case where an interracial couple was trying to rent a private home, and the homeowner refused to sell the property to them, rather, because of the race of the husband of the couple. And so they brought a lawsuit arguing that that was, you know, in violation of their rights. So in the case, the court explored the issue of whether Congress had the right to regulate the sale or rental of private properties, and in particular, whether Congress had the right to prevent racial discrimination in the private or public sale of real property. And in the context of arguing that Congress did have the right, the government pointed to Section 1982 of the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which in that act argued that all citizens had the right to enjoy property and contract rights as enjoyed by white citizens. They connected that act to the 13th Amendment, and they argued that by preventing a Black citizen from accessing contract or property rights as enjoyed by other white citizens who could purchase or rent homes in any context, that they were furthering what is called a badge of slavery. So this case provided some language to begin thinking about this concept of a badge of slavery that actually had emerged in the 19th century. It emerged sort of in a case. It wasn't a central claim of the case when it emerged, but it was this concept that there can be certain systems or actions or behaviors or cultures that perpetuate the harms of the slavery system that existed during the antebellum era. What the court said in this context, and I'll quote, "Just as the Black codes enacted after the Civil War to restrict the free exercise of the freedmen's rights were substitutes for the slave system, so the exclusion of Negroes from white communities became a substitute for the Black codes." So effectively, what the court was saying was that Congress indeed had the power to restrict racial discrimination in the context of housing, because racial discrimination in that domain perpetuated the same kinds of oppression that existed via the slavery system. This case ultimately would become an exception to the rule because it was applying the 13th Amendment in a context that existed outside of labor, but it put forward the precedent and the example that slavery as a political and economic system existed beyond the confines of the plantation, which is to say, abolishing slavery was more than simply abolishing enslaved labor. It was abolishing the culture and systems connected to it, and segregation in housing or preventing people from entering into certain contracts because of their race was part of that slavery system. We saw it in the slave code specifically, but it was perpetuated even afterwards via the Black codes. And part of the work of the civil rights movement was to try to dismantle that Jim Crow system that was perpetuated in the early 20th century with laws that were extensions of these Black codes and went into housing, went into transportation, went into sort of where you could access food and what kinds of hotel accommodations and things of that nature.
So access food means going to a restaurant. Like, that's what access food means to me. But food insecurity means being, you know, we have food deserts, like especially in the Deep South, where the dollar store has taken over and there's no fresh food, or, you know, you don't have access to food because it's so expensive, which in my mind is a little different than, say, going to a restaurant, trying to buy a house, entering into a contract. So I guess I'm trying to make the connection between how the 13th Amendment would be used in context of food insecurity versus kind of the traditional unfortunate experiences that even a law student reads about, you know, in the case law, you know, like, you know, going to all these barbecue or, you know, which I know is a different amendment, but something like that.
Absolutely. So there's a short answer and a long answer. And I'll submit that this article is really trying to push scholars to think creatively about the 13th Amendment. What I will say is, in the case law, the concept of a badge of slavery is not well defined. It's really ambiguous to a certain extent. And as a result, most courts have limited the definition of a badge of slavery as something that is, in fact, a literal rearticulation of slavery as it existed in the antebellum era, or something that we can directly connect to slavery in the antebellum era. So you're right. The question would be, what does food insecurity have to do with slavery? It seems tenuous or not connected.
Well, Yeti, and you just, you know, you hit the nail on the head in a way, because, and this is why your scholarship is so important, the view is so narrowed, you know, that this idea that it's got to be connected to being enslaved. I know that's a diversion from the first question I asked you. I apologize, but I just wanted to kind of have that aha moment and go back now, I guess, to how this is broader than I think what many people unfortunately kind of view when they think about the 13th Amendment.
So as I noted in the Alfred V. Mayer's case, they reference the Civil Rights Act. And if you look at the specific language of that act, it effectively says that all persons should have the same right to make and enforce contracts as is enjoyed by white citizens. And that was the basis of the court's, that was part of the reason why the court argued that racial discrimination in housing was perpetuating a harm that connected to the work of the 13th Amendment. What I think is interesting in that statute is that the way we define what it means to fully experience citizenship is that as is enjoyed by white citizens. I think it's problematic for a number of reasons. One, it suggests that all citizens who are racialized as white enjoy property and contract rights. And even in the antebellum era, that was not true. There were citizens who were racialized as white, who were poor, who did not own property, who did not have the ability to engage in contracts. So in many ways, it perpetuates this, you know, for lack of a better phrase, a white supremacist idea of what it means to be a full citizen. Normatively, the experience of citizenship is that enjoyed by white citizens. So right away, what I observed was that we did not have a clear normative definition of what citizenship meant. And that, in fact, was the central argument that the Reconstruction Congress was trying to resolve. What does it mean to be a citizen? Because that would then require the government to provide access to those opportunities and resources. And so we have the creation of the Freedmen's Bureau, which says, well, citizenship means you need access to land, you need access to education, you need access to contracts, right? So the Reconstruction Congress creates public education. We have we almost have land reparations come into play, but that's later taken back. But there's all these questions about, well, do we need property? Do we need access to education? Do we need food? What kinds of social and economic resources do we need to fully experience citizenship? Ultimately, the question that's never answered is, how does the system of slavery harm the people who we should be viewing as equal citizens? And how do those harms linger in society as badges of slavery? And so part of the project of this paper is to try to articulate a conception of the harm of slavery that undermined the experience of citizenship. And here I use the concept of dignity, which we use in constitutional jurisprudence. We invoke in a variety of different ways across our case law, but there isn't a concrete and cohesive definition of dignity, right? If I said the harm of slavery was a harm to the dignity of the enslaved population, it seems like a very amorphous and ambiguous term. So part of the project of this paper, and maybe the central contribution, is to try to push us toward thinking about a definition of dignity by pulling together various conceptions of dignity in Supreme Court cases and other constitutional cases, and then connecting that definition of dignity to not only the harm of slavery, but then the project of abolition and reconstruction. If slavery harmed the dignity of the enslaved, or if slavery, put another way, subjected the enslaved to dignitary harms, then the project of abolition is to remedy the dignitary harms that they experienced, right? That allows us to think differently about what the Freedmen's Bureau was trying to do and why it was extending into various domains. It also allows us to think differently about a badge of slavery. If someone experiences a dignitary harm that is similar to the kinds of dignitary harms that were perpetuated by slavery, then maybe that's a badge of slavery. And so that allows me to think about food, and more specifically, food oppression, as a badge of slavery, which is to say, if someone's experience of food is similar to the way someone experienced food during the slavery system, and it's very important to think about slavery as a system that controlled how people accessed housing, how they accessed food, how they accessed jobs, how they accessed property, how they accessed the courts, right? That was a system that was created by an economy that evolved around slavery and that subjected people to a variety of dignitary harms. If people experience similar dignitary harms today, then maybe that's a badge. And I identify three prongs of what a legal definition of dignity would be. The first prong is dignity as liberty, which is a harm to one's liberty that infringes on their experience of citizenship, right? So limitations to how I can will the self to certain means and certain ends, right? Where I can go, what I can do. And so we can think about that in the context of transportation, right? Accessing restaurants, things of that nature. Where can I go? Racial segregation. That's a kind of harm to one's dignity as liberty.
But where you're allowed to go, where you have access to go.
Where you're allowed to go.
Right. Okay.
Right. The second is dignity as equality, right? So how I am perceived, the way that I am perceived as an equal citizen and the resources and opportunities that I'm allowed to enjoy based on my racialized status. Am I viewed as an equal citizen? And if I'm not, whether it's based on my race or gender or sexual preference, that's a harm to my dignity as equality. And the third prong is dignity as integrity, which is how am I perceived by others in my society, right? Do I experience social stigmas in ways that reflect an unequal perception of my human dignity, an unequal perception of my citizenship, right? And we saw the concept of integrity invoked in some of the same-sex marriage cases, for example, right? That is an infringement upon my integrity, my dignity as integrity. And so if we frame dignity in that way, we could think about how the enslaved class experienced harms to their dignity as equality, dignity as liberty, dignity as integrity, and explore whether similar dignitary harms exist today. And so in this paper, I describe how one might experience a lack of access to food as an infringement on their dignity as liberty. If I live in a food desert, there are no grocery stores where I live. So it's difficult for me to travel to a place where I can purchase food, right? That harms my liberty interests. I don't enjoy the freedom of accessing food in the same way that others might, right? So I have to live a less dignified life because I cannot pursue healthy food in the way that others can. I might live in a food swamp, which is a community that's inundated by fast food restaurants and unhealthy foods, right? A lot of low-income communities. Mm-hmm. And so I can access food. I'm free to access food. I have the liberty to pursue food, but the food options are unhealthy.
Yeah,
they're unequal.
Yeah, I get it. I get that. Yes.
So my dignity as equality is being harmed. And then what about integrity? Well, you know, we can think about going back in history, food stamps. Right now we have EBT cards, but there used to be a time when you had a colored stamp if you couldn't afford food and you had to pull that stamp out and everyone could see. And your only way to access healthy food was to show that stamp, and that became a social stigma, right? Or the kinds of stigma associated with welfare. But to be sure, the way we segregate food in grocery stores, there's a kind of rationality to it, but perhaps there's also a kind of stigma to it, or where people go to access cultural foods. There may be stigmas associated with it that harm the integrity that people feel. Am I perceived as less than by my community because of the hurdles I have to jump through to access healthy food?
And so I have two more questions for you. The first is, by identifying dignity of liberty, dignity of equality, dignity as integrity, does that give Congress, assuming Congress would act, the power through the 13th Amendment to rectify these situations?
I think so, right? Because I think ultimately that's the question. What does this mean? And we haven't seen many efforts to use the 13th Amendment to support either race conscience or very progressive legislation, because it seems outlandish, but to some degree, it's because we don't have a very concrete and robust definition of what a badge is, and we haven't thought about slavery as a system, and so we don't think about the vestiges of slavery as a perpetuation of some of those system components or features. And so Congress struggles to regulate market behaviors that harm marginalized populations. So you could think about the fast food industry as one example. There have been a lot of efforts over the years, even in recent history, to regulate how fast food restaurants target low-income communities, how they market their products. There have been a lot of battles over the labeling of fast food products, right? The nutritional labels. What are they allowed to say about the nutritional value? There have been many, many lawsuits. And in a lot of the outcomes as well, these people have a choice. They're free to choose whether they want to eat McDonald's or not, right? Mm-hmm. You can't sue us for making your child obese. That's your responsibility. And so there have been a lot of battles over how do we ensure that people can access healthy food? How do we address food insecurity? How do we rein in the prevalence of food swamps and food deserts? How do we create progressive programs without getting the pushback that this is a poor expenditure of funds? Or, you know, in the context of the American Rescue Plan Act, we tried to create legislation to address the egregious loss of Black farms across our country, across history. Right. And there are a lot.
I don't think enough people understand how important and what contribution and what percentage of a contribution Black farms are, Black cowboys, that kind of thing. So I think you're right. I don't mean to interrupt, but I just want to acknowledge that this is an important part of our food system. And I had to acknowledge that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's all connected. You know, when we think about food is so integral to who we are as a country and as a people. It's obviously a part of our everyday lives, but it goes all the way back to the plantation, the farm part, you know, where, of course, we're farming cotton for textile, but we're also farming food produce, right? And so as we transition from slavery to the post-emancipation era, we're continuing to wrestle with the farming sector and making that a fair industry. And we saw the rise of sharecropping, and the government stepped in to be sure to think about how to make that industry fair, but it continued to struggle. What role does the government play? And the market's vicious. And part of the reason why the market has been vicious for so long is because of these market logics, these market structures that are themselves vestiges of the antebellum era. Who has power in the market? Who has capital? Who can access financing? Who can access loans? When we talk about running a farm, I don't think we appreciate how difficult that is, how capital intensive it is, right? And so the question becomes, well, how did farmers run their farms during the antebellum era? To be sure, they relied upon financing, but they also relied upon leveraging property, right? Assets that they had. And one of the property that they had was in fact the enslaved, right? And so students in my secure transactions class, I always note one of the earliest forms of mortgages in our country was the mortgaging of people. Right? Using people as collateral to then get financing to expand the plantation, to expand the farming process. Well, we abolish slavery, right? And the government compensates the former plantation owners for that property, right? They pay reparations to the slave owners for that collateral, as it were. But the Black farmers don't have those resources. They don't have that financing. They don't have that startup capital, which is why sharecropping was so inundated by people of color because they didn't have access to financing. Mm-hmm. Yet, by the early 20th century, we actually did have a fair number of Black farmers. But across the 20th century, those numbers dwindled because of racial discrimination, because of other aspects of the farming system that perpetuated the same kinds of dignitary harms, right? Lack of access to land, dignity as liberty, lack of access to financing because of one's race, dignity as equality, right? Racial discrimination. And so if you can't access money to run your farm, you're probably going to lose the land eventually. And so there was a dramatic loss of land. 90% of Black-owned land was lost between the beginning of the 20th century and like the 1970s. Hmm. 90%.
Wow.
And so the Pigford lawsuit against the USDA became the largest civil rights settlement, over $1 billion, right, in the late 20th century, paid out to farmers who experienced racial discrimination by the USDA. When Ronald Reagan became president, he dismantled an office in the USDA that was designed to address civil rights complaints. And so the basis of the Pigford lawsuit, which was settled because the USDA basically said, yeah, we did it. Over a decade, they simply threw away the complaints. Hmm. Right? Black farmers were submitting civil rights complaints and they were just being thrown into the trash. Hmm. They weren't.
Well, if that's not a loss of dignity, I don't know what is.
and you know, there are many, many Black farmers that to this day are still struggling to figure out how do they build themselves back up. Right. The result of the lawsuit was either a one-time payment of, I think, $50,000 or a larger settlement if you could provide concrete evidence that you had been subjected to racial discrimination. And that requires, you know, many, many challenges. Those who are familiar with the 14th Amendment and, you know, it's very difficult to prove the intentional discrimination and to bring forward all the evidence when it's a system at work that's really causing the lack of access. And so one wonders, you know, could the Biden administration have put forward progressive legislation? As some legislators have called for, Senator Warren, Senator Booker, they put forward a legislation called the Justice for Black Farmers Act, right? Could legislation like that stand on the 13th Amendment? Could it say, we recognize that there are systems in place that continue to harm people based on their race. And so we're going to create a program to provide resources. And Lindsey Graham said this is reparations for Black farmers. But the program was far more robust, right? They were trying to create educational resources to train people who lacked access to training and education. They were trying to provide business development, not only debt relief, you know, but also access to financing. And these are hardworking folks who just want access to opportunities. So it's more than simply a concept of reparations. It's really trying to level the playing field in the market where it's much harder for some people to start up a business than it is for others because of these vestiges, because of these system flaws, if you will, that persist from generation to generation.
And in a way, that brings us full circle to what we learned from you in the very beginning, which is that the purpose of the 13th Amendment wasn't just to abolish slavery, but to move forward toward equality for those who were enslaved and their ancestors. This has been so interesting and enlightening. I've learned a lot. As you were speaking, I kept thinking about those three themes about dignity of liberty, dignity as equality, and dignity as integrity. And I think that that is the kind of landscape against which we have to judge situations that on their face may seem just fine. But if you look, you peel them back one layer, really are oppressive, and for lack of a better word. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I will put a link to your article in our liner notes. And I really have appreciated this. It was very interesting for me.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to share.
So there you have it. Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you have a topic you'd like us to discuss, or a professor or attorney with whom you'd like me to speak, send us an email at legaltenzer@westacademic.com and send us any suggestions you may have. We love getting feedback. Have a great day. This podcast was created in collaboration with West Academic. Additional episodes can be found on the West Academic Study Aids Collection. Students may already have access through their school subscription and can check with their law school library for access. For a limited time, Legal Tenzer listeners can save 15% on titles on the West Academic store with the promo code TENZER15 at checkout.